We'll call the meeting to order. The clerk will note the roll. We do have a quorum present and a very, very heavy schedule today, members. So, as usual, I appreciate your cooperation. At least until Chairman Johnson returns, and then you can decide at what level you want to cooperate. Representative Emmer will move the minutes of the March 29th meeting. Members, any additions, corrections, deletions to those minutes? Seeing none, we'll vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Those minutes are adopted. Members, we also have the lengthy set of minutes from the March 27th meeting. Representative Dean will move those minutes. Members, any discussion with respect to the March 27th minutes? Seeing none, we'll vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Those minutes are adopted. Members, the first bill on the agenda today will be House File 3723. Representative Johnson is presenting another bill, but Representative Lilly has graciously volunteered to pinch hit on House File 3723. Representative Lilly, good afternoon. The chair will move.
Just a second, Mr. Chair. We're actually not in a position to work with it right now. We have a delete all amendment that we're still waiting for. So please, could we show up later on your agenda, please?
Okay, understood. We've got some administrative issues with House File 3723. Not a problem. We will temporarily lay the bill over and put it on the agenda for later on this afternoon.
Thank you very much, sir. Good luck today.
All right, members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3674, Representative Paymar's bill. Representative Paymar here. All right, Representative Paymar is not here. We'll move on. House File 923, Representative Holber. Who wants to present a bill today?
1845.
Representative Coles here. I'll just move on down the list. Oh, 1845 has been pulled. House File 1845 will not be heard today. Representative Mahoney, House File 3185. Going once, going twice. Representative Abler, House File 3283. No takers. Representative Vandeveer, House File 3526. Maybe we will go home early today. Representative Greiland, House File 1106. Representative Cornish, House File 2812. That's the agenda, members. This is certainly an odd situation. We have a timely forum for once, and no bills. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, I know that Representative Paymar is not here to present his bill, but I know that Representative Saitow is here, and I know he has a number of other people that are here to testify. I don't know how you want to handle that, but...
Representative Nelson, thank you. You make a good point. Certainly, we do not want to waste committee time as well as the time of the people here who have shown up today. So that's certainly something we can do. We will not move the bill formally until Representative Paymar arrives, but certainly Representative Tao, I know you and some witnesses would certainly like to testify with respect to this bill, and I think that's a good idea. The way that we'll handle this, members, is that the advocates of this bill will get 30 minutes to present their case. The opponents of this bill will likewise receive 30 minutes, however they wish to use it to present opposition testimony to the bill. Then what we'll do, members, is move into approximately 20 minutes of committee time to ask questions of either the author, Representative Tao, or the witnesses. And then at a time certain, then after that, we will take the vote and move on in our agenda. Having said that, it is now 20 minutes to... Representative Tao, certainly we can move on to calling witnesses in opposition to this bill. So first on my list, and I'm going to apologize right off the bat if I'm sure I will pronounce names incorrectly. It's not my intention to do so, but that's going to happen, so I'll apologize at the outset. Chair recognizes Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of disappointed that the author of the bill is not here. I'd like him to see the whole presentation before we move forward, but all right. Representative Paymar is here, so maybe they should go first, since it is their bill.
Representative Paymar, are you ready to present your bill?
Good
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry I was being late. I didn't realize we were first on the agenda. Can I get a page to pass these out?
Certainly.
Yeah, just subdivision two. Mr. Chair, could
Representative Famar.
Could you move my bill for me? So
absolutely. Representative Famar, you weren't in the room. The way we're going to handle this is we will give you and your witnesses a 30-minute block of time to present your bill and testimony on behalf of the bill. Then likewise, the opponents of the bill will get a 30-minute block of time. Then we'll move into 20 minutes of question and answer in committee discussion. Representative Famar, I will move House File 3674 that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Finance. Representative Famar, do you have any author's amendments for your bill?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. If I may, I'd like to move to amend on page 1, subdivision 2, delete subdivision 2. And then I also have on page 2, line 12, delete this chapter and insert 517.02. And I think that gets it the way we want it.
Ms. McKnight, did you get those oral amendments?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would actually be to delete Section 1 from the bill because the only thing that Section 1 does is add this new Subdivision 2. And then on page 2, line 12, delete the words this chapter and insert Section 517.02.
Representative Paymar, is that an accurate reflection of your oral amendment?
That is, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any discussion to Representative Paymar's amendment? Seeing none, all's in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Representative Paymar, is the bill now in the form in which you'd like to present it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Chair recognizes Representative Paymar.
Well, thank you for hearing this bill, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3674 amends Chapter 517, adding the words may gung to the list of people who can legally solemnize a wedding, and my testifiers will talk more about the responsibilities of the may gung in a moment. Basically, as I said, it allows a may gung to solemnize a wedding, to legally solemnize a wedding. We also are making two changes to Chapter 626. That makes it a form of child neglect to allow a minor to marry without voluntary consent, and makes marriage solemnizers of all faiths and all cultures mandatory reporters. I want to say, first of all, I don't bring this bill lightly. I know that the Hmong community, and I've met with many of the Klan members this morning, I know that the Hmong community is divided over this issue. And I don't relish being on opposite sides with Representative Tao, who's my friend and who's a fellow colleague and a fellow St. Paul legislator. But I feel that the issue is critical, that we resolve this issue. Our intent is to protect underage people, in especially girls in the Hmong culture, from being forced into marriage. It is also our intent to provide protection to people who are culturally married but don't have their rights recognized by the state. While I do not want to impose my views on any culture, people of any culture who reside in our state are expected to comply with our laws. While we are a quilt of woven cultures and while we respect individual customs, the state has a duty to ensure that our children are protected. House File 3674 does precisely what House File 707 did, which was a similar bill that was introduced by Representative Tao and Senator Moa. But the House File 3674, in addition to authorizing the Mae Gong to solemnize marriage, provides accountability and protection. So today I have with me Eileen Herr, Ann Carroll, and Linda Miller that will provide some testimony on the need for the bill. I want to say that this bill, similar language, there's a few changes, and the Senate passed out of their Public Safety Committee unanimously. I know that this is a controversial issue again in the Hmong community, and I'm committed to working with them between now, if the bill passes, till it gets to the Public Safety Committee, when I'm a member of that committee, to try to mitigate any concerns that they might have. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Herr.
Okay. Ms. Herr, good afternoon and welcome to the committee. If I could ask you and the other two witnesses, this is an evolving witness list, and so we don't have your name, so if you'd please spell your name when you identify yourself for the record for our Ms. Loudon here, who takes all our notes, kindly, I'd appreciate it. Ms. Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eileen Herr, spelled I-L-E-A-N. Last name is H-E-R. And I am here playing two roles. One is I am the director for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, a state agency working on policy and advocacy issues on and for the behalf of the Asian Pacific American population here in Minnesota. And two, I come before you as a Hmong woman speaking on an issue that is very controversial within the community right now, but I think is needed. I have here some things to hand out to you as I talk through my testimony. What we have here today in House File 3674, and I ask you to move on it and to pass it forward, is very similar to what you all saw in the 03 session with House File 707 at that time, authored by Representative Tao. At that time, the bill had basically three provisions. One, allowing marriages to be solemnized among the Hmong by the Mekong according to the form and usage of Hmong culture. And two, that the parties to the marriage would be the one to certify, to file the certificate of marriage. That was Representative Tao's bill in 03. The third provision was about retroactivity of marriages in the past, which this committee did not approve of or did not pass. In 06, what we're doing is basically the same thing. We're asking for the same thing, that the Mekong be given the authority to solemnize marriages. But at the same time, we want them and we want to hold them in line and with the same accountability that all solemnizers have in the state of Minnesota. Primarily being, and I think we took it out in with the amendment, but still the desire to have Mekong file and register in a county in which their intent to solemnize. Two is that we will make Mekong become mandatory reporters like other ministers and judges. And three, that Mekong be the one to file the certificate of marriage. And again, like Representative Paymar alluded to, that we expand the child neglect to include allowing a child to enter into a marriage regardless of whether the marriage is solemnized or not. And this third provision was in response to the fact of people saying, what about parents, particularly with underage marriages or underage cultural marriages? I want to be very honest with you. And the fact is that within the Hmong community, cultural marriages happen every week, every month, every year. Right now, we don't know what that number is, but I can estimate in the weddings that I've been asked to go to or invited to attend, cultural marriages, one or two weddings every week of that I know of. So weekly and monthly, there are cultural marriages being performed by the parties to the marriage. The Hmong marriage is not parallel to a traditional marriage in the sense of mainstream. There are many components to a Hmong marriage. One being the announcement that there is a desire to marry. And then this announcement is initiated, and the parents respond by finding negotiators, finding Mekong. Mekong is a term of art. You only use it on one instant and one instant only. And that is when a negotiation needs to happen for a marriage. When you talk about Mekong, people know automatically what it means. It's synonymous to judges. You know that judges play a certain role, and that word can only be used in one instance. So once the Mekong has negotiated the terms of a marriage, they bring that back to the parents. It's the parents that authorize the Mekong to negotiate on their behalf. And they come back, and the parents would agree to the terms or not agree to the terms, and then they go back to another round of negotiation. Once the terms of the marriage is agreed to, it's the parents that agree to it, not the groom or the bride, but it's the parents. Once that has happened, then there is a feast. So there are basically three elements. There's a feast, and once the feast is over, then the whole community recognizes that, yes, a marriage has been completed within the community. The Hmong has asked a good question, and that is, within Minnesota law, is there a place for the Hmong to be able to solemnize marriages according to their form and culture? The state of Minnesota, the legislature, has the authority to delegate the solemnization authority to individuals of your choosing, whether it stays with the state, as in with judges, or it goes to religious entities and ministers, or in this case, to a particular cultural group. That is up to the legislature. That is within your power and your authority. However, the community asks the question, can the Hmong community perform marriages, and can we solemnize those marriages within our culture? Because there is a need, marriages, cultural marriages are happening every day. And because it's cultural marriages, and there is no one with authority to solemnize marriages, then many, many of these marriages are not legal marriages, and there are many ramifications with regards to that. So at the heart of this legislation is a response to a question. Can Hmong solemnize marriages? And choosing the Mekong is not something that we chose, but something that was put forth by Representative Tao, Senator Moore, 18th Clan Council, and other leaders within the Hmong community. They put that term forward in terms of picking the spectrum. Who would most likely hold this solemnization authority? Would it go to the parents? Would it go to the bride and the groom that only marry once? Or would it go to a Mekong who is called on to negotiate marriages? My intent with this, in this whole process, is to look at the question and to find a way in which Minnesota statute would allow for that. My purpose is not to preserve a cultural tradition. My purpose is not to do other things besides answering the question, can Hmong Mekong, or can the Hmong find a way in which to practice their culture and get those marriages be legal? There are many other things, but I'm going to pass it on to the other two testifiers, and if there are any questions, then I'm more than happy to answer them.
Ms. Hurst, thank you. Representative Paymar, who's next?
Good afternoon. My name is Ann Carroll, A-N-N-E-C-A-R-R-O-L-L. just make a few quick points.
Ms. Carroll, if I could, another thing I forget to ask. If you're representing a particular organization, we would like to know that as well.
I am not, although I do serve on a community-wide Hmong Youth Task Force, from which I draw some of my information, but I'm not here as a representative of any organization.
Thank you, Ms. Carroll.
Thank you. This year's House and Senate bills address the core points of a 10-year-old effort to recognize and honor the marriage traditions of the Hmong people in the state of Minnesota. The House bill, as amended this morning, treats Hmong solemnizers as similar solemnizers are treated without establishing burdensome requirements that are unique to the Hmong. That's an important issue that you may hear come up in other settings. This has been a point of contention in the past, and I believe it's been resolved at this point. Concern has also been expressed regarding penalties for not filing a certificate of marriage. It's important to note that this is not new language. It is simply being applied to all solemnizers, and it is a simple process of delivering the piece of paper that records the marriage as legal under state law. For every one of you whose marriage is legally recognized in Minnesota, some official person filed that piece of paper, and that's what records it as a legal marriage. So it's not particular, it's not a change, it simply says it applies to everyone. The bills also add an important clause in the child neglect statutes that protects all children from all religions and all cultures from being subjected to parental attempts to marry them when doing so is deemed illegal under state marriage laws. Again, this applies equally to everyone. No group is being singled out in this case. The important clause for mandatory reporter in the mandatory reporting statute also adds all solemnizers to the list of mandatory reporters, but it appropriately limits the mandatory reporting clause to marriages deemed illegal under state law. You don't have to mandatory report for any number of other things. It's just for marriages deemed illegal under state law and only within the confines of their roles as solemnizers. So it doesn't mean that if a solemnizer from any of the groups listed under the special provisions bumps into someone who has done something illegal is to have reported. That is not the case. It is only within the confines of their being asked to perform a marriage. It is already the law for members of the clergy, many, many professionals, educators, all kinds of other people, and it applies equally to all solemnizers. Again, there is no singling out of this particular group of people. If these provisions become law this year, I also hope that in the future we can tackle some key provisions around retroactivity and amnesty that affect thousands of innocent Hmong adults and children, as well as those in other cultures who are at risk under state law through no fault of their own. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carroll.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Linda Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R, and Linda is L-I-N-D-A. I am an attorney. I've been an attorney 30 years. I graduated from William Mitchell with Senator Neville, and I am speaking on my behalf. In 2001, I was working with an organization that helps Hmong women, and I was at a meeting, and Ramsey County Probation Officer Tom Thompson came up to me and said, "Linda, we have to do something." He said that we needed to help the Hmong community understand our marriage laws. So I put together a seminar, and you have one of the articles that occurred at that time all of these are articles about that seminar, and it was on Hmong TV as well. At that forum, Chief Cohen spoke, Chief Judge Cohen, he was Chief Judge of Ramsey County at that time, several other people, and then Probation Officer Tom Thompson got up and he said that he had 13 Hmong men on his probation, who were his probationers at that time. They were on probation for criminal sexual conduct. They were on probation because they had married under the Hmong customs, and that they weren't the usual criminal sexual conduct offenders that he dealt with. These were men who married a wife underage, which is criminal sexual conduct under state law, and they did it in accordance with their custom. So as his probation officer, he felt very uncomfortable. He was very sad about this. These men had to go through the criminal sexual conduct notification, community notification procedure, which was very shaming to them. They couldn't find a place to live. They couldn't find a job. They had previously been employed, but they couldn't find a job now. He also felt really bad because the young girls that they had married were having babies, and they would call him up and they'd say, "Oh, please just let us show him his new baby, just once." And he would have to say to them, "If you show him his new baby, I will have, and I find out about it, I will have to revoke his probation and put him in jail. And I may have to report that you put that child in danger because you allowed a criminal sexual offender to have the baby or touch the baby. So I may have to ask Child Protection to get involved." He did not like this. He didn't like the expense that the whole public was being put through. Then finally, the reason why he came to me was that one of his probationers had violated his probation and may have been deported. It's a deportable offense, criminal sexual conduct under U.S. law. And so that young man may have killed himself in response to that understanding that he may have been deported. This broke his heart. This is why he came to me, and this is what he said in these, at this forum that we did.
Ms. Miller, thank you. Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, that concludes the testimony for now. We'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. And what we'll do again, members, is, as is our practice on bills that tend to be controversial and emotional, we'll allow all testifiers to get an opportunity to get their words in before we move to committee discussion. Representative Paymar, thank you. If you and your witnesses would kindly stick around, we would appreciate it. Members will now move into up to 30 minutes of testimony in opposition to Representative Paymar's bill. Representative Tao. I don't know if you want an opportunity to testify or to introduce your witnesses. What's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Before I move into my testimony, I would like to get a couple things clear. I would like to ask Representative Paymar a couple questions before I move on with my testimony. Is that all right?
So, Representative Tao, what I would prefer to do is to hear from your witnesses, and then certainly when we move into committee discussion time, you will be given an opportunity. As I understand it, you and Representative Paymar have an agreement worked out regarding dialogue between the two of you. Is that true? You worked something out with Chairman Johnson? Representative Paymar?
Mr. Chair, if Representative Tao has questions of me or my witnesses, he's, you know, I'm happy to have, if it's to clarify the bill, I think that would be highly appropriate.
Okay. Like I said, Representative Tao, let's hear from your witnesses first, and then what we'll do is we'll turn to you first when we move into committee discussion.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to start off, and then we'll bring my support testifier. Throughout our history, two things that people are willing to die for, land and religion. Now, this country was founded by people who left because they were prosecuted by their religious belief. And I strongly feel this bill attacks my religion. Now, for the members of the committee to fully understand the impact of this law, and for us to have a debate, discussion, I think it's important that we all understand the Hmong wedding process and who is involved in this process. For the record, I have invited Representative Paymar and Senator Skoglund to Hmong weddings so they understand the real role of the Mekong. Both have refused. I have these. Can I get the tape to it? Okay, we start out with hold this for everyone to see. Okay, I'm going to explain the process of a Hmong wedding. Number one, the couple decides to get married. Number two, they leave the parents' house. The groom's grandfather waves a chicken over his head. Okay, it sounds silly, but that's how it's been done for ages. She stays with the groom's family for 3 days. She's not allowed to do any chores. Then she takes her to the mall to shop for new clothing. The two family then sets up a time for the wedding call. The groom's family have a feast. Gifts and money are given to the groom and his new bride by his family. The two families then proceed to meet at the bride's house. The two families talk about the wedding and the ceremony through the Mekong. Feasts and gifts and money are given to the couple at that time. The groom's side returns home with the new bride. And a small dinner is made to thank everyone involved. And here are the people that are involved in the wedding process. The Mekong just play one role in it. Now here's the role to describe what the Mekong's role is. There are two sides. The red is the bride's side, the green is the groom. There is a family representative, the guy with the hat. If you are a green Hmong, you have one Mekong. If you are a white Hmong, you get two Mekongs. Okay? And then there is a group of about a dozen people who are also at the ceremony. The Mekong's job. Now this is where the disagreement is. The Mekong's job is to carry the message between the two families. They do not negotiate anything. They do not solemnize anyone. If we have to pick someone to solemnize anyone, it would be the bride and the groom wanting to marry and the wishes are granted by the parents. Okay? You could take that down, please. Now the Mekong's job, he is a volunteer, usually a distant relative. who acts as the messenger, the go-between the two families. Usually 100-year grievances are brought up at these ceremonies, and they have to be paid or fixed before the marriage ceremony can proceed. We need the Mekong to provide that buffer between the two families. And our culture is 5,000 years old, and we have used that system as long as we can remember. We only been here 30 years. And there, someone is asking us to change the role of our Mekong, which is our religion and our culture, and make him a mandatory reporter. Now think, he is a community member. He could be very specialized, or he could be a guy that knows nothing and willing to act in the middle, buffer between the two families. The idea for this bill is to make the Mekong the solemnizer and then make him the reporter for make him a mandatory reporter. And child abuse has been discussed. I feel this bill will not do anything to stop child abuse that they insist that it will. Here's why. There are three ways that a Hmong wedding could be, the couple could be considered married in the Hmong tradition. One, they go through a complete ceremony, which is the one I explained to you. If both the bride and the groom agrees to get married, they initiate the wedding ceremony. If the groom wants to marry the girl and she doesn't want to, what you would do is he would come with his relatives. They come and they start passing out money, okay, to her family until her family feels sufficient. Then they start the negotiation. If she says, no, I don't want to marry this guy, then he leaves the house, and that's the end. For everyone to know that she does not want to marry him, okay? Then that's the end of that marriage. But if she decides to, then they proceed with the ceremony. Number two, an incomplete ceremony. You could have a ceremony initiated, it gets halfway, you can't, you know, you have 100-year grievances. I've been to two of these weddings, and you can't work it out. The family leaves. The groom's family just leaves. She follows him. They come home. They marry. They're considered married. They have kids. No questions asked. Number three, no ceremony. My wedding, my wife and I, we decide we want to be married. Talk to our parents. They say yes. We planned the reception. That was the end of it. No one in this room would dispute that I'm not married. So, if this bill moves forward, it does nothing. Anyone, if they sense that this bill is going to target the Hmong community, what it will do is it will move everyone to option three, where there are no ceremony. And in many ways, that will destroy our community. It will destroy the way we have practiced that religion for 5,000 years. I have two daughters. I would like to see them marry with the option of having a Mekong if they want to. I honestly feel that this bill specifically targets the Hmong Mekong in the Hmong community. You know, we have a lot of bills that gives rights to certain minorities, but we have never seen bills that take away their rights or demand that they should practice their religion one way or the other. In regards to the child abuse comment that has been made, I admit there are pedophiles, sexual predators, and other criminals in the Hmong community. And in any community, there's no denying it. But if that's what we want to do, which is to protect children from being abused, then I say let's do that. You will not protect anyone by going after the make-on, the messenger. The only thing you will do is destroy the culture. Here's what I would propose. I propose we kill this bill. Apparently, whoever went forward with this bill today did not consult with the Hmong community. There's one person represents the Hmong community. Many of these people here are here today not because in support, but in opposition. I'm sure there's enough talented Hmong community members. Here's what I propose. I want us to kill the bill, set up a task force within the Hmong community and legal professionals like Ms. Davis, get them involved, come up with a comprehensive proposal to deal with both issues, marriage and child abuse. I'm willing to do that. I have started that process last year, and I commit to you by the end of this year, I will have a bill ready to put that task force together. Now, in closing, the Hmong community has been here for 30 years. Some the full 30, others less, the refugees, 9 months. Those that are here longer have changed a lot and continues to change every day. Those that just got here recently are slowly changing. This bill will not only change our culture and religion, but it will impact that population the most. They are the least educated about our laws and least sophisticated about American culture. It is our job to help them. If not, then allow them the opportunity to change at a pace that they can handle. And Mr. Chair, members, I have a couple of the testifiers that would like to come and, the official testifier from my list, Xiong Bao from the Hmong Culture Center.
Representative Tai, I don't see the name on the list. That's neither here nor there. It won't prevent the person from testifying. But again, if we could have a spelling for the record and everything, and what group
it's
they represent.
It's in the handwritten piece I give to the.
Okay. Its name one more time, please.
Xiong Bao.
Yep. All right, we've got it. Mr. Pop, you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee members too. My name is Xiong Bao Li, CXONGPAO and LEE, my last name. I am an actual Mekong and also the executive director of Hmong Cultural Center in Minnesota here. I'm testifying today in the opposition to the Hmong marriage bill currently being considered by your committee today. The Scotland and Tamar Hmong marriage bill was developed without consulting Mekong or non-Christian Hmong community, which in the main group that actually used Mekong for their marriage. At the Hmong Cultural Center, we have taught hundreds of Hmong men and women the Mekong marriage ceremony over the past 14 years. It is very disappointing that the author of this Mekong bill did not consult with us or other Hmong cultural organizations like the 18 Clans Council to learn more about Mekong and their role in the Hmong culture. Before submitting the bill to be voted on, it would seem logical that legislation focusing upon the traditional Hmong cultural practice of marriage and the Hmong Mekong should be developed in consultation with those cultural specialists and educators who have expertise on the Hmong culture and the Hmong Mekong. It is very disappointing that did not happen in this case. In fact, both Representative Tao and Senator Moore, the only Hmong elected official in the legislature and who must answer to very large Hmong constituency in this district, have both publicly gone on record in the past few weeks stating that the Scotland Paymore sponsor have Hmong marriage bill is horrible and will not be helpful to the Hmong community. The proposed Scotland and Paymore sponsor Hmong marriage bill opposed by the Representative Sai Tao and Senator Moore gave the Hmong Mekong a new role that has never previously been associated with this one-time marriage ritualist in the traditional Hmong villages, who unlike priest and minister is not involved in any long-term social work activities with the community, but rather play and breathe, but in princess ritualistic role in the perceived and story type of social L of Hmong culture in a single belt. The legislation effectively criminalized the Hmong Mekong, many of whom are elderly, have not had an opportunity for formal education due to their age and refugee life history, and do not yet possess naturalized status and the full right of citizen. Hmong Mekong perform the marriage ceremony. They do not have social worker function in the Hmong culture. Hmong Mekong also do not force people to marry, as the author of the bill seems to think they do. The families of bride and groom only approach them, perform ceremony after the bride and groom have moved in with one another for purpose of getting married. In the Hmong culture, I would like to invite any of you, of the members of your committee, to attend a Hmong wedding ceremony in the future, so you can see the actual role of the Hmong Mekong and the religious ritual or the performance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
I would like to invite this time a parent, Yi. She does not speak English well, so I will interpret for her.
That's fine. And great. And Representative Tao, of course, if you'd identify the witness and spell the name first, and I would note that you get the shade over 10 minutes left in your time. Representative Tao.
Yee. Yang, Yang.
Thank you, Mr. and
she has a son who is 16 years old. A young lady, 21, came and took her son away. She never forced anyone, but they willingly came together. Right now, she has not performed any ceremony for them. They want to get married. Because her son, the 16-year-old, is not legal, and they want to get married, she wants to ask advice from the legislature. If this proposal passes, she can't perform. Right now, she does not want to perform the ceremony culturally. But at the same time, if this bill passes, it will criminalize her if she allowed that to happen. Because in some ways, it will be forced. And she would like to get some advice from the proponent of this culture bill if it does move forward. So you could address that later. Thank you. If there's any questions.
Thank you. Representative Todd, the gentleman to your right there, do you wish to testify as well?
Honorable Chairman, members of committee, guests, friends and relatives, thank you for giving me this opportunity. And before I make the testimony, I would like to make a brief introduction.
Hey, sir, if I can interrupt for a moment, could you state your name and spell it, please, for the tape and for a second?
My name is Vang Lo, V-A-N-G-L-O, and I am the president of the Hmong Aiken Council, representing the Lo family. And along with me today, I have all the 17 clan leaders or clan representatives. I would like them to stand up. And also the concerned families from the Hmong community. Ladies and gentlemen, what we have here are the Cha representative, the Cheng, the Chu, the Fa, the Hang, the He, the Kang, the Li, the Mua, the Pa, Tao, Wang, Wu, Xiong, Kong, Yang, and Ku. That's 18 clans representatives sitting over here. Together, we as representing the Hmong Aiken Council, also serving as one voice for the Hmong community as well. As of today, it has come to the Hmong Aiken Council's attention that the Hmong marriage, providing for solemnization of the Hmong Marriage Bill House number 3674, has been proposed to pass at the House of Representatives. We have great concern after reviewing the proposed bill. This bill has not been discussed nor being supported by our Hmong community. The Hmong community has not been informed of this bill before. We as clan representatives of the Hmong families have many questions and answers needed as to how this bill would benefit and jeopardize our Hmong community. As the 18 Hmong clan representatives, we are requesting that this bill be postponed until our community is given time to examine the details of this bill and to modify the bill as to how it should serve our Hmong family. As the president of the Hmong Aiken Council, I wanted to stress that Hmong culture is a complex one, and the bill should be consulted and supported by the Hmong community. For example, the Hmong Mekong do not make the power to solemnize any Hmong marriage, but by the parents and their family clan leaders. It would be disservice to Hmong people to have this bill passed at this time. On behalf of the Hmong community, I am requesting to have the bill postponed until the Hmong community and their clan leaders have a chance to review and revise the bill. I am calling for your support in keeping and respecting our traditions and practices so the Hmong family can continue to live in peaceful and harmony society. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tao.
I am informed that the Native American representative would like to say a couple words as well.
Certainly. We've got approximately 5 minutes left. It's by Ms. Linetti.
I won't need 5 minutes, Mr. Chair.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Christine Zimmer Linetti. I'm here representing the Prairie Island Indian community, and I just have a very brief testimony. The Prairie Island Indian community was just made aware of the fact that Native Americans have been included in this bill by Representative Tao. The council did not have time to review what the bill might or might not, how the bill might or might not affect the spiritual leaders and the solemnization of marriages within the Native community, and they were not consulted in the discussions, and therefore they wanted to at least get that testimony on the record and could be included if there is to be some kind of a task force group. Thank you.
Ms. Linetti, just an administrative clarification. You said the bill by Representative Tao. Did you mean Representative Paymar's bill?
I mean Representative Paymar's bill, but we were just notified regarding the bill through Representative Tao.
I told them. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Tao, you get about 4 minutes left.
We will squeeze as much time as we can with the Michael Yang will introduce the next group, and they will take it from here. This is Yia Ku, Y-I-A,
K-U-E.
I will attempt to translate for her. She wants to share with the committee that as a parent, the Mekong do not advertise themselves. As a parent, you have to go ask a Mekong to help you. They are clean people. We ask them to come and be our voice between us and the other family, so we will not argue with each other. They don't come ask us to hire them for service. We have to go and beg them for their services. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Joa Lee, Y-O-U-A-L-E-E. I want to tell you this bill, Toshia, her heart aches. Her husband is a Mekong. Her husband, they have to come and bring wine, whiskey, and ask her husband to be a Mekong after they have been married for 3 days. He is not there to force anyone to marry anyone. In the U.S., we have police. They get in the middle of two families. That's what he does. He gets in the middle of two families. And now they accuse the Mekong of forcing children. The Mekong has never done that. And now they want the Mekong to sign things. The Mekong does not want to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Got about a minute left, Representative.
She said the words she already said here, whoever introduced the bill has to carry the burden of that word, and she does not want the Mekong to carry the burden. So she wiped her hands clean. Her name is Zaw.
C-H-A-O.
C-H-A-O.
Y-A-N-G.
Y-A-N-G.
Yeah.
Oh, Vang. V-A-N-G. She has sons and daughters. This bill makes her heart ache. The job of the Mekong is not easy.
Representative Tao, we need to wrap it up.
We don't want this bill to pass. I have six sons, six daughters. I do not want you to tear our culture apart. We have used this for ages.
Thank you, Representative Tao. We're going to have to wrap it up here. We are over 30 minutes. We will move into committee discussion. Representative Tao, I said I'd recognize you first. Get a question for Representative Paymar. So Chair will recognize Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like, first off, I would like Representative Paymar and Senator Skoglund is here, if he wants to, and Eileen Herr, state for the record what is their religious background.
Senator Skoglund, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. It's up to your discretion if you wish to answer that question. If you do, just please identify yourself for our audio tape.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Paymar.
Before Senator Skoglund addresses, we didn't take our full 30 minutes, Mr. Chair, and I wonder if Senator Skoglund, who was in session, could have a few minutes to address his religion and also to at least make a couple of comments on the bill. We had hoped that he would have been able to be here on time, and it just didn't work out that way.
Okay, Representative Paymar, by my recollection, he had a little over 5 minutes. So, Senator Skoglund, the chair will recognize you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for allowing me to appear before the committee. The Senate is in session right now debating the Game and Fish Constitutional Amendment, but I got myself excused to come over here because I consider this so important. I'm sorry I missed the earlier debate and the topics that you covered, but I think you need to realize why I introduced this bill and why I've been working on this bill for over 3 years. It's because young girls under the age of 16, are being put into cultural marriages, sometimes against their wishes, other times even with their wishes. But in Minnesota, we do not allow anybody to consent to marital-type sex under the age of 16, and they are being pressured into that type of situation. I know you're all feeling under pressure. I've been under pressure. I don't know how many of these folks I've met with in the past, but I've met with probably 175, maybe 200 people at the Hmong Center down on University Avenue. I've had my office packed with people, maybe some of the same people here. I don't know. I've met with them in office 237 of the Capitol more than one time. I've been through the same meetings that you've been to. But if you think of the pressure that you're feeling, just think of this 14-year-old girl who's being pressured into marriage. These marriages are occurring weekly. Now, it's not in the census. People don't go out and report it. You don't file a marriage license, but it's happening. Talk to any Minneapolis teacher. Talk to any Minneapolis social worker. Talk to any St. Paul principal. Talk to youth workers. And they will tell you it's going on, and it's going on with a great deal of frequency. Kids are in school. They're gone for a while. They come back with a baby, if they come back. They're gone for a while. They come back with a second baby. They're gone for a while. They come back with a third baby. It is occurring. These young girls are having these babies by men twice their age and even older. We've got to do something. We wouldn't stand for that. We wouldn't stand for that. And I was asked my religion. We wouldn't stand for that in the Lutheran Church. We'd be out protesting, I hope, that this is wrong. This is immoral. These girls deserve a teenage life. They deserve an adolescence. Let them get their high school educations uninterrupted and go on to college. But for some reason, we're pressured into saying that we're We're not going to do that. This bill has been around for several years. I first heard the bill, quite frankly, in the year 2003 when Representative Powell introduced the bill to allow the solemnization of marriages in the House. It came to the Senate, and they brought the bill to the Senate. And it was much the same bill in terms of giving Mekong the ability to solemnize, except that it had a retroactivity provision in it that allowed marriages that they had solemnized in the past to be recognized if they were done within the previous year. It was at that hearing that we learned about these young girls who are being married off culturally. I want to add culturally, at ages 13, 14, and 15. And at that hearing, we decided we've got to do something. And we put in the mandatory reporting language. We said that if we're going to give people this power, then they must be mandatory reporters. That's the same power that every minister has, every priest has, every rabbi has, all the other religious people in the state who are allowed by law to marry people. The non-religious people, the government people, already have that obligation. I shouldn't say just the power, it's an obligation. Judges have it. Court administrators have it, and the only other two governmental people we allow to marry are the administrators of the school for the blind and deaf down in Faribault. For obvious reasons, they can conduct a marriage. But they're mandatory reporters. So it's saying that the Mekong should be mandatory reporters if they're going to legally solemnize marriages. I first heard about the bill from Representative Towle, again, when they wanted to solemnize marriages. Now, when we're saying that they should be mandatory reporters, we're being told it shouldn't be done. Now, the one argument I've heard against the bill is, why don't we enforce the laws that we have now? Well, I agree, we should enforce the laws that we have now. We ought to crack down on these guys, these older guys that are marrying younger women. By older guys, I mean guys in their 20s marrying 14-year-olds. But that's after the fact. The girl ends up pregnant, and then we enforce the law. Why can't we save that girl from this kind of thing so she can have a teenage life, so she can go to junior high and go to high school and so on? Why wait until there's a victim before we crack down on the law? Yeah, crack down afterwards. I totally agree, but let's protect the girl from the start. So on the record, I've stated I'm a Lutheran. That's the end of my talk.
Thank you, Senator. Being respectful of the Senator's time, are there any questions for Senator Skoglund? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Skoglund, currently you stated in your testimony that it is illegal for anyone under the age of 16 in the state to marry. Is that correct?
Senator Skoglund.
Mr. Chairman, kids who are 16 and 17 can get married with the permission of the court. People under the age of 16 cannot give consent, period, for sex to be married or anything. There's no exceptions to that law.
Correct. No one under 16 can currently be married.
And you Representative
said,
Dean.
You said in your testimony that you had social workers and teachers that you had in previous testimony that had reported that this is taking place, and you said the age of 13.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Skoglund,
we did not have testimony from social workers or teachers, but I've been working on this bill for 3 years. Every Minneapolis teacher I've spoken with, every St. Paul teacher I've spoken with, and I haven't spoken to all of them, every social worker I've spoken with, every principal I've spoken with, knows of a case or two or three or four or five. I've even had encountered people who acted as Big Sisters, Big Brothers, Big Sisters program, who have told me about girls they've been involved with who have become moms at age 14 because they become the wives of cultural weddings. So, but no, we did not have testimony on that, if I recall correctly. So,
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoglund, it would seem to me that either a teacher or a social worker who knew of a 13-year-old who had been in a cultural marriage would have, as you said, the mandatory obligation to report that, and that would be a cause of criminal prosecution. So I'm just wondering why we haven't seen anyone from Education Minnesota or the counties who could have brought these cases before us so that we could have some actual data on if 13-year-olds are indeed engaging in this. It's not anecdotal, but actual fact-based with some folks and some teachers groups behind that.
Senator Skoglund.
Glad to respond. I wish I had thought of going to Education Minnesota to have them testify. That would have been good. What happens is the girls disappear. They're gone from school. In Minneapolis and St. Paul, it happens not just with Hmong girls, with a lot of kids. They're just gone. They're just gone. And they come back with a baby. Or they come and I will tell you, in Ramsey County, where most of these are occurring, there are some prosecutions that take place. It does occur. But my point is, why wait for the girl to be victimized in order to do something? Let's prevent, let's keep that girl from being victimized. There's not one of us here, if it was our daughter, our granddaughter, our niece, our godchild, somebody else we really cared for, that wouldn't intervene first. And I'm saying the people who these girls don't know about, but who are gonna, we're going to have to count on to save them, are you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that?
Representative, okay, Representative Tao, and then we'll go to Representative Simon.
Right here we have testimony of a lady who said her son is 16. The lady is 21. She, her son and the young lady want to get married against her wishes. She testified that here today. But there is also another drive in the Hmong community, Hmong culture. If someone comes and say, my daughter, my son wants to marry your daughter, and you don't go through the ritual, then you are ostracized. So now this lady has to choose between being ostracized or going to prison by initiating the wedding. So right now she doesn't know what to do. That's today. And so we are making this. This is a very complicated issue. This bill does not, will not address what Senator Skoglund is trying to do at all. I admit there are young girls and young guys who decide to get married against the wishes of the parents. What do we do in that instance? Do we punish the parents and the Mekong? Or do we try to solve that problem? If they want to solve the problem, let's sit down and solve that problem and not punish or alter someone else's religion.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we've got the three principal authors here, I'm not quite sure who this goes to, but probably Representative Tao. If I understand the timeline correctly, at one point in the 03 session, the Hmong community, or at least you on behalf of the Hmong community, did want the state to recognize Mekong as solemnizers of a marriage. So I'm just trying to understand the position as you see it of the Hmong community. Your position is, well, one of two things as far as I can tell. Either that you're not so sure anymore whether they should be official state solemnizers, or if they are recognized as solemnizers of a marriage, they should not have to abide by the reporting requirements that apply to rabbis, priests, ministers, and so forth. I'm not quite sure what the position is on the threshold issue. Should they or should they not be solemnizers?
Representative Tao.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Right now I have five different versions of the bill, and each one of them has a different person that solemnizes. One, we allow the community, kind of like the Quakers, after a ceremony has been taking place, allow six people to sign the marriage certificate, a legal document. Number two, allow the parents' representative. And then number one is the Mekong. And then the other one is just make it kind of generic, where all minorities or all groups who do not fall within current law, such as a priest or pastor, just allow them to perform their ceremony. That's the extent of my bill. This today is not my bill. If it was, I will be supporting what they're trying to do.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, just as to the Mekong, the one situation that you outlined, the first one, I think, of the ones you just said, you would be okay, theoretically, having that person recognized in statute as a marriage solemnizer. That would be okay, but not with the other conditions that this bill. In other words...
No, not today, Representative Simon.
No, not with this bill.
Representative Simon.
Yeah, I have five different...
Representative
versions.
Dow, let's keep the tape clean, please.
Okay.
So, I have five different versions. I'm still trying to pick which version fits best. And I think it's appropriate if before I pick, I have to consult with the community on what they think is the best version.
Representative Simon.
So, but I just want to make sure, just generally speaking, because I'm taking at face value that you believe you're representing the will, the majority probably of the community. Are you saying that that you believe that having a Magong be a solemnizer is a good thing, but just not with other conditions? I'm just trying to understand what the feeling of the community.
Representative Tao.
If I have to pick today, I would not pick the Magong as the solemnizer. And I do not represent the Hmong community. 30% of my district are Hmong, so those 30%.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Tao, I was listening to one of the charts that said that there's three options: ceremony, non-ceremony, and no ceremony. I might have missed
incomplete
ceremony. But then you just said that there are young kids out there who are getting married against the will of both their parents and the Mekong. So, one, I'm trying to figure out who's recognizing that as a marriage, and two, whether you think that's okay.
It is not okay. The community recognized when you say, I marry her, essentially, if everyone else believes it, that's the end of it. No one questions whether you are marrying her or not. That's how it is. I know it is not okay, but is it worth it for us to go after the Mekong to try to solve this issue? I think the issue is bigger than just the Mekong bill here. It's a intercultural, cultural differences, different religions and culture come into place. Let's work on those issues. I've been putting bills out there to help resolve these issues. And I would be more than happy to have anyone else help me. But before we move forward, I think we need to involve the Hmong community in finding these solutions. I don't think we should sit here and try to help them from themselves.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up.
Sure. Representative Broad.
I'll be real quick. And Representative Tao, I guess what I'm getting a little confused about is that there's been so much testimony on the importance of the Mekong to the process of getting married and to the Hmong community. But yet that same community then is recognizing marriages that go through an alternative path, mm-hmm. not using the Mekong, right. or not abiding by the wishes of the parents. So I'm seeing that there's some competing things going on, and maybe that's just a confusion that I'm having in terms of where the Mekong really rank in terms of the priority in terms of the marriage.
Representative Tao, and then we'll give Ms. Hur a chance.
Representative Broad, the Mekong has been elevated because we made it. We drafted in legislation. If I was to pick someone who was responsible for that whole wedding, it would be the parents. After the couple who decides to get married, that would be the priority that I put it in. Ms. Hur wants.
Ms. Hur.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. With regards to the recharge of the married, whatever. A real official marriage within the Hmong community is one that has been through negotiation, the parties agree to it, and then there's a fee. That's a full recognized one. I can start living with someone and the community will recognize that that is a marriage, but in effect, that is not, to their sense, it's common law marriage versus a legal marriage. So in the Hmong, there's also different spectrum of what is in the Hmong sense a legally marriage within the Hmong community. There are many different ways. Hmong that are Christians marry in the church, and that's considered marriage. They don't do some of them don't do the Mekong negotiation anymore because they follow the precept of Christianity. I'm right now Lutheran. And so we have a minister, and we don't do the negotiation through the Mekong. This is for the traditional cultural aspect of the community that wants to practice traditional marriage customs. For that, the right and the proper way is to go through the Mekong. Now, lots of times, people don't do that because you can do whatever you want. But overall, the community would like for them to go to the proper wedding marriage channels. That is through the Mekong and the negotiation.
Mr. Representative, Just a moment here. I've got Representatives Lesh, Emmer, Nelson, and we will vote no later than 2 o'clock, so please keep that in mind. Representative Tao.
I object to what the testifier just said. My wife and I, we got married without a make-on. Any make-on. I object to that last comment that it has, that my wedding is not legitimate in the Hmong community. So...
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I'd say Representative Tao stated he had about 30% of his district being Hmong American. I don't know if anyone has close to that except for my own district, anyone in the House. And this is an issue of substantial importance to me for reason. But when I found out this bill was coming up today, it was about a week ago, I was contacted by Representative Paymar and yourself, Representative Tao. And so I had to do a little checking, because in the wake of that, I hadn't talked about this much with a lot of people in the past year. And, of course, it came out mostly in 2003. My question, and based on the language, is, you know, we're not just talking about Mekong when we show this bill. 2.11 and 2.12 on page 2 of the bill would make it a misdemeanor for anyone, even if Mekong were not statutorily solemnizers of marriage. My question is, though, the issue on one side of this bill is, why are you making Mekong susceptible to criminal prosecution for something that really isn't their role? And the other side is saying, hang on a second, we need to regulate this because of all the bad things that are happening. So my question is, why is it that the Mekong are the best people to be accountable for this when the other side is saying they're not, especially considering a marriage certificate, which, according to 517.14, should be accurate? Why can't it be the recorder who is to monitor the dates of birth of the people who signed that? When that comes across the desk and that's recorded, and it shows that this individual is underage, it should be relatively simple for a person at the county to say, this is invalid, this shouldn't happen. And at that point, Representative Paymar, Senator Skoglund, wouldn't that be the best point where we could approach that and say that this is bad news?
Senator Skoglund, Chairman, if there was a marriage certificate, would be. But they can't get a marriage certificate to begin because they're too young, they're too little. If they're 17 or 16, a judge could say they could have a marriage certificate, but, you know, and that would be legal. That would be a legal marriage if a judge said it. But if they're 15, 14, and 13, they can't get a marriage certificate. There is no marriage certificate. While you've been focusing on Mekong, the bill covers anybody who's involved in arranging that marriage. We say Mekong and others who are involved in arranging the marriage. So if the dad is trying to set the daughter up with some guy in a marriage, he's guilty of a misdemeanor. It's not a giant crime. Utah has it as a felony, by the way. They've had problems there with... I don't want to call them Mormons because they're not Mormons, but they once were Mormons, of young girls being married off there. And it's been a major problem in Utah and Arizona, not major in a statewide, but there's hundreds of girls this has happened to. They've made it a felony, and they're throwing these guys in prison like they should, including the parents who set up these underage marriages. So the argument has gone to Mekong, but all this does for Mekong, who wants to marry a 19-year-old, guess what? He actually gets to sign the marriage. He doesn't marry. He's a matchmaker. He, though, gets to sign.
What?
I should say they get to sign the marriage certificate for the first time. They get to do it. They actually have the legal authority.
Representative Lesh?
Just a brief follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is also, it was stated that this was not meant to single out the Hmong community in this, and yet we have language that's possibly, well, pretty much geared toward the Hmong community to address... an issue that was stated about underage marriages. It applies also to Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, Baha'i, Quakers, and American Indians, but we only had one other individual in here for one of those groups testify, and that was because she was alerted to it. I'm wondering, why is it that when this comes up, you've got a situation as what most people are familiar with, they call it statutory rape, but in this case it was testified to as criminal sexual conduct under Minnesota law. Isn't that much more effective way to approach this, which would get at the root of the problem?
Senator Skoglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess if it stopped it, it may be, but it hasn't stopped it. Ms. Harris testified it's happening weekly. Secondly, I suspect the religion of everybody at this table or the person they were married by was covered by the mandatory reporting law. My minister is covered by the mandatory law. Representative Tamar's rabbi is covered by the mandatory reporting law. Those of you who are married by a priest, he's covered by the mandatory reporting law. If you're married by a judge, he or she is covered by the mandatory reporting law. The people who aren't covered by the mandatory reporting law we're trying to bring in. By the way, I asked the representative of the Indian community if she had read the bill. She hadn't read the bill. She told me she hadn't read the bill, which embarrasses me to think that we had testimony of who had read the bill and testified about it.
Representative Tamar, briefly.
I'll wait till there's one more question.
Okay. Last, Representative Emmer, briefly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mine is for Ms. Herr, because I've been listening with interest on both sides, and I'm sorry, but I stepped out of the room right when you started to testify. What is your title and what is your role here? Ms. Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Elmer. I am the Executive Director for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, a state agency that is to work with the Asian Pacific community on working and advising the state legislature on issues that are important to the Asian Pacific community. And this is a very important issue, a very controversial issue. I handed out a one-pager with listing the pros and the cons. I'm trying to make public policy here, trying to help advise you the best way to this issue and the issue at hand. I don't want to, that's why I didn't focus my testimony too much on underage marriages, forced marriages, even within the community of practice right now of marrying more than one wife. So I don't want to focus too much on that. I wanted to focus on the question, can Hmong, within its culture, solemnize marriages? Can the state give that authority to the Hmong? And under what conditions would that authority be given to the Hmong community? And I think we've brought up a very good compromise, a very good first step. We're not going to resolve all the issues that are on the table today, but I think knowing the fact that every month, every week, that there are cultural marriages, how do we get them to be legal marriages?
Mr. Chairman,
giving the Mekong or the families an ability to say, you're underage, we're not going to marry you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Herr, I appreciate that that's your position. What I'm trying to get an understanding for, and I would like confirmation, because I've heard several folks from the Hmong community come up and testify either as best they can in English or with the help of interpretation. Do I understand correctly that you are here today in your capacity representing the Asian Pacific Council? Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, that is correct.
Representative Emmer.
So, Ms. Herr, is this, because I've heard testimony that there hasn't been a discussion in depth with the community, is there some Asian Pacific Council resolution or some other...
Ms. Herr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, thank you for that question. The council board did pass a resolution last year that with regards to this issue, that we would work to be the voice of the children. That if this is a bill that contradicts or actually harms underage children, that the council would take the position that we would be for protection and for the protection. With regards to, this is 3-4 years old, and we've had this in 02, 03, and now in 06. There's been plenty of community discussion. In 03, the same groups that are now opposing to this piece of legislation, they were for it. They were all for it. If in 03, Representative Tsai's bill had passed, and the Mekong got the ability to solemnize, they would have all been very, very happy with that. Myself and other people spoke and said, you know what, if we're going to give the Mekong the power to solemnize, let's give them some accountability measures. And that's when the opposition stepped in.
Representative Emmer, last question.
It is my last question. It should be a simple yes or a no. But my question is, what is the council's official position on this bill? And I don't mean the one that was offered 3 years ago, or I understand Senator Skoglund has been working on this for a long time, and I've heard Representative Tao talk about his many different proposals. I'm talking about this bill that's in front of us today. What's the council's position on this bill?
Ms. Hurd, does the council support, yes, oppose, or is neutral regarding,
sure,
this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Elmer, with this particular bill, they've not taken position, but this bill was the same one that was passed in the Senate, okay, with the amendment. So they, every element that is in this bill right now, they are in agreement with.
Thank you. Members, we are past time, so therefore I will renew my motion that House File 3674, Representative Faymar.
Can I just in closing ask you to do this? If you believe that there is a problem, and I think we've made the case that there is a problem, is this the perfect solution? I'm not quite sure. If they don't, if the Hmong community doesn't want the Magong to be the solemnizer, maybe someone else would. But I would ask you to do this, is to pass this, to pass this bill without recommendation, so it goes to the Public Safety Committee, give us an opportunity to meet with people who have concerns or ideas about how to make it better, and we will do that.
Thank you, Representative Faymar. With that, I renew my motion that House File 3674, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is recommended.
Division.
Division has been called. All those in favor, raise your hand.
Four, five.
All those opposed?
One, two, three, four.
By my count, 5-4, the bill prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right, members, my intent is, although we were scheduled until 2:15, we do have this room. I would like to go until at least 2:30 and then give members an opportunity to attend pre-session briefing with their respective caucuses. Have we resolved Lily's problem with the amendment, with his delete all?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Lily, are we squared away on your delete all amendment?
Yes, sir.
All right.
No.
That been handed out to the committee? All right, Representative Lilly, the chair will move House File 3723, that it be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register, but I understand you do have a delete all author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we do. This is a good bill about people that want to participate.
Okay, Representative Lilly, before we go to you, members, do you all have the DE1 amendment? Everybody get that? See. No, says Simon.
Mr. Chair, I don't even know what bill we're on.
Okay, we're on House File 3723, first one on the agenda. It's actually Representative Johnson's listed as a chief author, but yep. Representative Lilly is pinch-hitting for him since he's involved in the eminent domain.
That helps, Mr. Chair.
Yes, it is the H3723DE1 amendment.
Maybe I can talk as it's passing out to help move things along.
It's coming around right now. Representative Lilly to the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a good bill about people that want to participate in elections. As Mr. De La Forest mentioned, this is a bill that is authored by Representative Johnson, and he is quite busy today, and thank you for having us today. It's kind of a exciting bill. It's people, like I said, that want to participate in elections. There's essentially two parts, and we have a delete all amendment, and in the amendment it'll talk about the first part is people that are deaf or deaf and blind, and they want to participate in precinct caucuses, and then the second part is some minor clarifying language. So we have, as we mentioned, we have the delete all amendment, and we have two testifiers here with us today. And Mary Hartnett, that's with the Minnesota Commission serving deaf and hard of hearing people. And we also have Jamie Taylor here to my left. And I don't know if Mary's here, and if she, I think we're going to go to, if that's okay with the chair, I would like to go to Jamie Taylor. She has a few words to say.
Ms. Taylor, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, my name is Jamie Taylor. Mr. Chair and members of committee, my name is Jamie Taylor. I'm here representing the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People and also the Minnesota Deaf Blind Association. I want to thank Representative Johnson for introducing this bill and also Representative Lilly for his support. I'm here to speak in support of House File 3723, which is what you're hearing right now. This bill changes old language that makes it difficult for deaf people who use American Sign Language to go to the precinct caucuses and participate. It also eliminates misleading language that's in another statute. First, let me introduce myself. I am deafblind. I'm also a graduate student at the University of Minnesota. 2 years ago, I became part of the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearings People Get Out the Vote effort. We helped to get over 500 people signed up for voting, registered for voting. This year, I became a trainer through the Minnesota Participation Project to teach deaf and deafblind people who use sign language how to go and participate in precinct caucuses. I have advocated with the Secretary of State's office to make the website, their website more accessible for people with vision loss. I am committed, as I know you all are, to making the system more accessible to all. But there is a slight problem. There is language in the books that makes it difficult for deaf people to participate in caucuses. The law requires that deaf people send in a certified letter in the mail to the district committee of the political party they want to participate in 30 days before the precinct caucus date. This bill was written before the passage of the Americans with Disability Act. This is not only difficult, but also unnecessary. It is hard enough for hearing citizens to go to the precinct caucus and try to convince them to go. But for deaf people, the communication barriers are huge. This year, MCDHH got phone calls from deaf people who said they were told that they had to request in writing 30 days before the precinct caucus to get an interpreter so they could attend. The new language removes the 30-day requirement, allows the person to request an interpreter by email and to contact the central office of the political party, and the staff people will be there to answer the email. It will make it easier for deaf and deafblind people to participate. We would also like to get rid of language that says and implies that observers and election judges can serve as interpreters. They may observe and assist, but they cannot be interpreters. Thank you for your time and listening.
Okay, thank you. Members, we still have not formally adopted the DE1 amendment. So is there any discussion to the DE1 amendment itself? Okay, seeing none, we'll vote to adopt the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Lilly, before we move on, question to ask, given the time, is there anyone here to testify in opposition to this bill? All right, I don't see anyone, Representative Lilly. That should be a good clue for you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Jamie again for coming in here and testifying. And any members have questions? If not, I think it's a good bill, and you can certainly work over me or Representative Johnson as it moves along. But thank you for your support.
Members, any discussion of the bill? Okay, seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3723, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Representative Lilly, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Olberg. Oh, already making her way up. House File 923.
All
right. Where is that? Let me find it, Representative Holberg. Representative Holberg, what's the amendment number?
Is it
the 1205 amendment? You've got a DE1 amendment?
I'm sorry. It would be the A061205.
Okay. The chair will first move House File 923, that it be recommended to pass. Representative Holberg, where's your bill going?
Mr. Chair, it's going to the floor.
All right. Referred to the General Register. We have the bill before us. Chair will then move the A06-1205 amendment to get the bill in the form in which the author would like to present it. Representative Holberg to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, we had this bill in front of the committee last year, and Ms. Parker has done quite a bit of work on it to address some of the concerns that were brought forward last year, and she's here to answer any questions. In general terms, let me get my sheet here. Oh, there we go. What it would do is, under the process of appraisal and negotiation, it would increase the reimbursement amount to $5,000 for commercial and industrial, increase the amount of time from 60 to 90 days, and then allowing the acquiring authority to pay the appraiser directly instead of the landowner having to pay the appraiser first of all, and also requires the exchange of appraisals. Section 2 would allow for a process when MnDOT acquire property and get money for surplus property. It would go into an account to help continue pay for the costs associated with right-of-way rather than their general highway user or their trunk highway fund. And then Section 3 has the language for the reconveyance to former owners with court approval. If there is additional property that MnDOT doesn't need with court approval, it could revert back to the original property owner. And Ms. Parker is here to answer any more technical questions as she has spent much more time on this issue than I have.
A committee discussion with respect to the amendment. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Holberg, for bringing this forward. One of the concerns that I know that I've expressed to Ms. Parker and in committee in general is that I'm just not sure that the cap is really the best way to do this. I understand and I appreciate that the cap is being raised, but it seems to me that if a governmental entity is paying for an appraisal at a certain amount, that the property owner should receive an equal amount from that governmental entity. The property owner is not going to find much cheaper of an appraisal out there, and it just seems to me that that's fair and would be a better way to do it as opposed to putting an arbitrary numerical cap. I had an amendment drafted, but it's not drafted in a way that's going to fit real well. But what I would like to see us do is essentially request that the acquiring authority reimburse the owner for the lesser of the actual cost of the appraisal or an amount equal to the acquiring authority what they spent for the appraisal of the property. And I'd be willing to work with you on that moving forward as opposed to trying to put inaccurate language on your bill.
Ms. Parker, do you care to respond to Representative Broad's comments?
Mr. Chair, and
Representative Holberg,
what we're trying to figure out is MnDOT has in-house appraisers, and so if Representative Broad, how would you assess the cost to the in-house MnDOT appraisers? They don't always contract out for this service.
Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd be willing to work with you on that, but essentially they contract out on a large number of appraisals that are done, and I would imagine that MnDOT would be able to put a value on the amount of time that their workers spend on an appraisal piece of work going forward. So I think that probably is something that needs to be continued to be worked on, but it's not an insurmountable task.
All right. Ms. Parker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT, for the record. I'm not sure exactly how we would do that, but we don't have any objection to the idea and would be willing to work with you on language to accomplish that.
Great, thank you. Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Parker, Representative Holberg, when you say you spent a lot of time working this out after the problems last session, I guess I have a problem with it, that statement, because aside from Subdivision 2 that talks about the appraisal, and I think Representative Broad has already addressed some of the issues with that, and the uniform standards that you would like to see put into statute, the rest of this thing is basically the same. And I would speak against Subdivision 4. First, we have a commissioner's hearing, and I think the commissioners are more than qualified to make decisions on evidentiary issues that apparently MnDOT wants to put in the statute, claim they're somehow unfairly surprised if they have a an appraisal that's too low and they're suddenly given an appraisal that's correct the day of the hearing. I think the people that are making the decision are more than competent to determine that. And then with respect to the last section, I'm really troubled that with all the eminent domain discussion we've got going around, we still seem that we need to put into law the ability of the state to take our property and then determine how they want to, when they don't want it, how they want to sell it back to us. They want to give us the right to maybe buy it back. Frankly, what I would like to propose at this point is a verbal amendment to delete Subdivision 4 through the end, the changes, leaving only the appraisal under Subdivision 2 and the that goes through the additional stuff that they would like on Subpart 3. That would be my oral amendment.
All right, where's Ms. McKnight?
I don't understand.
If you'd read back the proposed oral amendment,
Chair,
please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, are you saying that on page 2 you want to delete Subdivision 4? That would be lines 20 to 29?
Representative Emmer.
That's correct. And then also lines 232 onto page 3, going 3.9. And then I guess before I'd ask to strike 3.13 to 3.14, I'd like to know if I understood that correctly from Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Now, before we move on, let's make sure that we've got the oral amendment correctly before us. Ms. McKnight, can you read back the oral amendment, please?
No, Mr. Chair, to the excluding the author's question, in my understanding is on page 2, he wants to delete Subdivision 4. That would be lines 20 to 29. And then he wants to delete Section 2, which is has the caption appropriation. And that Section 2 goes on begins on page 2 and continues on to page 3.
Representative Emmer, is that your oral amendment? All right, discussion to the oral amendment. Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, no disrespect to my good friend, Representative Emmer, but Section 2 really is a transportation finance policy issue and where the money and proceeds from this process go, and rather back into the general pot, it would be that money that could then be used for other right-of-way acquisitions, et cetera, that was a policy issue that was supported in transportation finance.
Representative Emmer. No disrespect taken. I will withdraw that part of the amendment, which would be to delete 2.32 through 3.9. So all that remains then is subdivision 4.
Withdraw your amendment. Start over.
You want me? Mr. Chairman.
Whatever form is appropriate for the chairman, I'll follow. Ms. McKnight, if you'd read back Representative Emmer's modified oral amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment now would be on page 2 to delete lines 20 to 29.
Representative Emmer, is that your oral amendment?
Yes.
Discussion to the Emmer oral amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
Ms. Parker would like to comment.
Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, the reason Subdivision 4 is in here is because landowners' attorneys wanted language like this in the bill
people representing landowners felt very strongly about this language, and this was not part of MnDOT's original bill. But they felt that the argument all along about MnDOT's acquisition of land in these hearings is that people have felt that all of MnDOT's appraisals should be available to landowners, the ones we use and the ones we reject and don't use, including appraisals that we have prepared specifically for eminent domain hearings. And so this language was added in both the House and the Senate as this bill went through committees last year. And then it was decided, it started out in the Senate, I think, and moved over here, that if we had to give the landowner our appraisal before the condemnation commissioner's hearing, that if the landowner had an appraisal, the landowner should give his appraisal to the state in order to facilitate discussion and possible settlement, so that each side could see the other's appraisal and all the cards, so to speak, would be on the table. And that is what this language does. It says that neither side can use its appraisal unless they give it to the other side in advance, so that everyone knows what's in everybody's appraisals when they go to the hearing.
Representative Emmer.
Fair.
That's fine. The state already has to provide its appraisal, so I would stand by the amendment that I proposed.
Any further discussion to the Emmer oral amendment? Representative Hilty to Representative Emmer's oral amendment? Okay, we'll come back to you. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, can you just restate again why, what are you trying to accomplish by taking this language out?
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, I don't think we need the language, frankly. That's why. I think it's unnecessary, which is why I'm moving to delete it.
Any further discussion? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll speak against the amendment. It's my feeling that we need that in there, and we may, by having it in there, eliminate some unnecessary costs in going to a hearing if, in fact, the current landowner provides all of that information to MnDOT, and a settlement may be reached before it actually comes to a hearing.
Any further discussion to Representative Emmer's oral amendment? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
The motion does not prevail. That amendment is not adopted. Members, we do have the 1205 amendment before us. Representative Hilty, did you want to speak to the amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, since the motion was to pass this bill to the General Register, considering the all of the language in Section 2 of the bill, how is it that this would not go to Transportation Finance?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hilty, are you speaking to the amendment or to the bill or to
I'm
both?
I'm speaking to the amendment.
Okay. Representative Holbert?
Mr. Chair, this bill went all the way through committee last year and went to the floor, and at the end of session was returned to the committee where it was last heard. So it was this language was heard and, in fact, included in bills on the House floor last year. So the committee's already seen the language, voted it through.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, why is this a delete all amendment then?
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, if Ms. Parker would like to respond to that.
Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, this is a delete all amendment because originally the bill had two long additional sections that were enacted in other bills last year. And rather bring back a bill that had about five extra pages in it of language already enacted, we just did a delete everything amendment and took that out and kept what hadn't been enacted in other bills last year.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Holbert.
Representative Hilty, there was a lot of problems with the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill last year, and so only those things that were same or very similar in both the Senate and the House moved forward. And there were some differences in this language in the bill, and so it was just dropped in an effort to bring a non-controversial get-out-of-dodge bill during special session.
Say thank you. Okay.
Any further discussion to the 1205 amendment? Seeing none, we'll vote on it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Holberg, to your amended bill.
Mr. Chair and members, certainly I'm willing to work with Representative Broad on her concerns
relative to appraisal language, and I would hope that the committee could support the bill as amended.
Any discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 923, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say no.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is re-referred. Members, I think if we could get Representative Mahoney in real quick before the witching hour here. We move in expeditious fashion. Representative Mahoney, good afternoon. It's my understanding your bill is on its way to the General Register should it clear our committee. True?
That is correct.
Okay, the chair will move House File 3185 that it be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Representative Mahoney, did you have any author's amendments to your bill?
No, Mr. Chair. This is going to go as it is.
Okay, Representative Mahoney, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I brought witnesses, but due to the short time frame, I will try to get through this bill on my own. This is a bill that last year we the legislature saw fit to bring together a group of industry people underneath the Department of Labor and Industry to solve a problem where in the bioscience industry, you do not patent the product, you patent the process of piping and how you get to the product. Unfortunately, often when you are building a new building, you have to take the print, give it to the local inspector. That becomes public data. What this bill does is transfer all that inspection, and we did talk to a good number of local inspectors, and they were more than comfortable with what we were doing there. We transferred it all over to the high-pressure piping industry, an inspection division at Labor and Industry, and changed this the blueprints to non-public data. We have worked, as I said, with all the with industry, with contractors, with labor, with producers and inspectors, and everybody has come to an agreement that this is a very limited issue on biomedical, not ethanol. It doesn't involve farm products or anything like that. And I can stand for any questions that the committee may have.
Well, and I'll ask at the outset, is there anybody here to testify in opposition to this bill? Well, you know, if they're okay. Seeing none, any questions for the author? All right, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3185 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Representative Mahoney, you're on your way. Okay, members, we are going to recess the committee. I ask you to take all your paperwork. We will reconvene in room 10 at 5 p.m. sharp. Okay, the real chairman's here. He says 15 minutes after session. So 15 minutes after session, we'll be in room 10. Please take your stuff.
Including this.
Yes, take your stuff. Pack it out.
All right.
Committee stands in recess.
The question, is there anyone who'd like to testify against this bill? All right, I see no hands. So if you could give us your brief testimony, we'd appreciate that.
Great. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Christine Gepfert, and I'm an attorney for the Housing Preservation Project. We're a private nonprofit law office whose main focus is preserving affordable housing. My organization is also a member of the Minneapolis Affordable Housing Coalition, and we're working in the city of Minneapolis to change public policy on condo conversions. Very simply, this amendment would not eliminate the sunset provision altogether, but make it so it's only applicable to moratoriums. So if a city passes a moratorium, that will sunset after 18 months. But for cities who have a significant shortage of affordable housing and want to make changes to their local ordinances to address that shortage, they may do so now without those changes going away in 18 months and requiring them to reenact them, you know, every 18 months. So we see this as a positive benefit for cities who want to address their housing shortages. With that, I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the author or the witness? Representative Hornstein, did you have someone else who wanted to testify?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we've covered it. I don't know if Mr. Elwood, if there's anyone else that is interested. They certainly can testify, but I think we've pretty much, it's simple, it's straightforward. We got the issues on the table, so.
Great. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3631 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greiling, and then Representative Abler. Representative Greiling, I will move that House File 1106 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's an amendment also, I believe, in your packet that I would like moved. It's delete everything.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Mr. Chair, I have an amendment in the packet that is a delete everything, DE1.
All right, let me find that. I will move the H1106 DE1 amendment to put the bill into the form that the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. 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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then there is one oral amendment that the physician's assistants would like, and that is on line 1.4, when it says physician's assistant, to strike the apostrophe S. Apparently, it should just, since it says a physician, it should be a physician assistant without the apostrophe S.
All right, I will move to amend the bill, which is, but we're looking at the DE1 amendment on line 1.4, eliminate the apostrophe S after the word physician. Any discussion? And I will also move that on line 1.7 we do the same thing and eliminate the apostrophe S after the word physician.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And on line 1.17 we will do the same and eliminate the apostrophe S after the word physician. Thank you, Ms. McKnight. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill merely says that a physician assistant, certified nurse practitioner, or clinical nurse specialist in a psychiatric or mental health nursing facility is not civilly liable when they have prescribed medication for a prisoner or a person who's civilly committed up until the time when they would, after they've been released and when they would fill their next prescription. And, Mr. Chair, that's all this bill does. They have to follow standards of practice. This amendment was worked on with the providers and the trial lawyers, and at this point, I'm not aware of any opposition.
All right. Is there anyone who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Any discussion to the bill? All right. Seeing no discussion, I will renew my motion then that House File 1106, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
I like this committee.
Sometimes it doesn't go quite this well.
Let me
have no other.
Oh, right there. Okay.
Representative Abler.
Which long term care one? You want to do that one first?
All right. 3283, Representative Abler. Is that all right?
Correct, Mr. Chair. And actually, there's an amendment which I would ask you not offer today. It's still a work in progress. It's going to be taken up in health. It's not a civil law amendment anyway. Right. Just for convenience here. So out of the to the trees who died to sacrifice themselves, that amendment, I thank them.
All right. I will move House File 3283 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, the bill was discussed and debated and held over for some internal work. I know that Representative Weston had an hour-long meeting with the department, understands it better, and has come to some piece of it. Representative Emmer, I asked him if he had amendments to offer today, and he said no. So you were not here, but it was assessed and tabled for further work. That further work has been done, and it's ready to be sent off now to the Health Committee if members are so willing.
Okay. Representative Abler, I understand that Representative Westrum is on his way because he did want to offer an amendment.
Okay, well, so we can pass on this and go to the other bill if you want.
All right. Why don't we...
Because I have no other... All we have is we have witnesses for questions.
Okay.
If members have questions, we could do that now. Or
you actually have witnesses just for questions. Okay, why don't we wait till he gets here? It'd just be easier rather than going through it.
We did the testimony already for the bill.
Okay.
Representative Emmer now if he wants to talk about it.
I will lay 3283 on the table until Representative Westrom gets here, and we will take up House File 2831, and I just need to find that. I will move House File 2831 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, and I, unless the Chair could make an oral amendment for me, and then we will discuss the bill, and I think we'd like to take the word fault out on 9110, if you could remove the word fault.
All right, I will make an oral amendment. Line 1.10, eliminate the word fault and the comma following it. Is that right?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I do have one witness I'd like to allow to testify, and I we won't spend a lot of time on this bill. It's a really good bill, though. In the whole world, you live in this world much more than I, Mr. Chair, and watching tort reform bills come and go, and almost to me, I guess they mostly go. But I thought I'd found a project which I thought kind of ran along the knife edge, maybe if it's a razor edge, just to find the bridge, the dueling interests that seem to be ever present in this topic, as you well know, Mr. Chair. Having to do with the communication that goes on in the privacy of a doctor's office after something that's unforeseen happens. And as I understand, there's a lot of concern about being sued. And some doctors, in fact, when something bad happens, their first reaction is to be quiet, as they've been instructed or heard in the hallway. They better just shut up and not say anything. And it was the desire of this author that we could find with this language, we could then let them actually still be human, still retain their doctor-patient relationship, still being liable for the harm that happened. But allow them to at least be human, and maybe in so being human that the lawsuit might not happen because the humanity element carried forward in the patient would indeed be allowed to work through their whatever the challenge was. And without belaboring the committee with anecdotes, there's a whole bunch of them I could give you, but I'm not going to do that. So I'll turn it over to my witness, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Landrum, if you would, Mr. Chair.
All right, Mr. Landrum, please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, my name is Michael Landrum. I am an attorney, mediator, and adjunct professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law. I have offices in Edina, and I am part of a newly formed organization called the Healthcare Conflict Management Initiative. This is a bill that's been passed in some form or another in some 20 states. It's also very similar to portions of the National Medical Error Disclosure and Compensation Act supported by in Congress, supported by Senators Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And I'd like to talk just briefly about what the public policy objectives of this bill would be and how it would help fulfill them. And the public policy objectives are to enhance the quality of health care, improve access to health care, and reduce the costs associated with health care services. So the I'm sorry bill, which would make inadmissible statements of compassion, regrets, and so on, the first thing it will do is to reduce the anger of patients and the defensiveness of health care providers. Studies have shown that one of the principal reasons that medical malpractice cases go on, and in fact sometimes even why they're filed, is because patients felt like nobody talked to them. I have mediated a number of medical malpractice cases. One of the questions I always ask people is to say, what's been the worst part of this for you? And almost inevitably they say, no one has ever said they're sorry. And it makes it very difficult for them to move on. I've even seen their attorneys have difficulty with this when we reach a place where settlement is appropriate, but because there's no amount of money that's going to compensate for this anger, it poses another barrier. So that would facilitate productive information exchanges, which then would do a couple of things. It can first lead to better risk management practices and prevention of future unanticipated outcomes. It can also help reconcile the patient healthcare provider relationship, which in turn would facilitate early resolution of individual claims, which in turn would contain the transaction costs for the resolution of those claims. The better risk management practices and prevention of these occurrences will reduce the occurrences and claims on the part of providers, both institutional and individual. And that development will improve the individual and institutional healthcare providers' claim experiences, which will in turn be positively impact medical malpractice insurance premiums. That in turn produces three very distinct ways to achieve the public policy objectives that I articulated in the beginning. It will permit the allocation of more resources to the improvement of healthcare quality. It will reduce the costs of healthcare services that are passed on to consumers and healthcare providers and insurance companies. And it will reduce the number of doctors that are leaving specialty practice areas and even some geographic locations. There are states where doctors have simply moved out. Mississippi is one. They practice across the border in Louisiana because they can't afford to practice in Minnesota and Mississippi, and that means if a woman wants to have a baby delivered, she's got to go to Louisiana. So that's a summary of what we think the public policy objectives would be of this bill and how it would help attain them.
Thank you, Mr. Landrum. Representative Ebler?
Yeah, do you have any questions for witness?
Any questions for the witness?
Sure.
Representative Ebler?
Mr. Landrum, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Landrum, why is this going to, or how is this ever going to save costs when we don't have a medical malpractice problem in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Landrum?
Chair, Mr. Representative, I think the answer is not yet. And it's beyond the cost. It has to do with helping people heal from bad experiences that have happened to them. It also will help facilitate the identification of causes of medical errors and the prevention of future ones. So it's more than having to do with medical malpractice. It's having to do with increasing the quality of health care because it will facilitate some open and candid discussion.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
Landrum, that actually opens it up, though, because one of your selling points was, and I wrote it down, reduce health care costs.
Yeah, that's one.
But, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Landrum, in fact, it won't do anything to reduce health care costs because, number one, we don't have a medical malpractice issue in the state of Minnesota that's being caused by lawyers and lawsuits. It might be something that the insurance industry is looking at nationwide, but I don't know if you're aware that out of the billions of dollars spent on health care in this country, less than 2% actually involves medical malpractice lawsuits. But then you made another interesting statement that somehow this is going to stop the reduction of doctors. Do you have some actual numbers from all these different states as to how many doctors claim that they are staying in the profession because now they can say, I'm sorry?
Mr. Landrum?
There are those numbers. I don't have them at hand. I can have them to you by tomorrow.
I don't know the hammer. Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, Mr. Landrum, maybe it's an exercise in futility because it's not going to change my vote.
Representative Mr. Chair, I appreciate the committee's time. When I brought the bill forward, and I still believe this is something that split the divide, the divide remains. I believe it's prudent at this point that I just ask you to continue the bill.
All right.
Appreciate the time the committee has spent, and this will be a bill for another day.
Thank you, Representative Mabel. I will lay House File 2831 on the table now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Representative Amler, I'm going to have Representative Clark come forward just because she has a quickie, we think. So. I will move House File 3449 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar, Representative Clark.
Second. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. There's an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
H3449A1.
I will move the H3449A1 amendment to put the bill into the form that the author would like. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill just helps have a central repository of information on park manufactured park closings, and it will notify both the licensing agency and the agency that may be able to help the residents who may need some resources in transition. I didn't let one consent calendar bill of the year, I hope. It's really non-controversial. All the controversy has been taken out of it. And
Mr. Elwood, are you here for questions, or did you have testimony?
Mr. Chair, members, I am just here for questions.
All right. Is there anyone who would like to testify on this bill, I should ask? Any discussion or questions? All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3449, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much.
Representative Vandeveer. I will move that House File 3526 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Public Safety and Finance. And is this your amendment, Representative Vandeveer?
It is, Mr. Chair.
All right. I will move the H3526DE1 amendment, I assume, to place the bill into the form you would like?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Right.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3526 is intended to provide a quick resolution of false lien filings by victims of harassment or fraud through improper UCC filings. And here to explain more of the bill and provide some testimony is Bonita Harville from the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you, Ms. Harville. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Bonita Harville. I am a business analyst from the Office of the Secretary of State, and I've been a filing officer for that office for 10 years. Basically, the bill before you establishes an expedited judicial review of UCC financing statements. A UCC financing statement under Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code is recorded to pledge a security interest. These recordings can be either filed at the Secretary of State's office or at any of the county offices designated as satellites. An example is if you need to buy a tractor, you'll go obtain a loan, and once the loan officer gives you that, they create a security agreement between you and the bank, and they file a UCC financing statement with one of the filing offices in the state central filing system. This bill addresses those individuals who use this system fraudulently. It allows an expedited judicial process for those who are victims of this process. Currently, the process takes a great deal of time and is costly to those who are victims in order to remove that record from the state filing system. Is there any real harm in filing this? Yes, there is. I'll give you one example. A Wells Fargo Bank employee had joined our task force and came to us and stated that they hadn't thought there was any real harm until they went to refinance his home, finding that somebody had filed a bogus lien on them, making it much more timely and costly. In order for him to refinance his home, he had to get the bogus filing removed. Another example, in Dakota County, inmates file financing statements on those who not only impose the sentences, but those who also administer the process. So in this case, the victims were all the way up from the court clerks all the way to the judges. At the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, I was approached by the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, who stated that this is an epidemic among inmates filing bogus filings, and he's very glad we are addressing this issue. And who does this affect? Well, everybody is potentially a victim. As a filing officer for 10 years, as I've stated, I can attest to the fact that many public officials are the victims. We have judges, elected officials, court staff, county clerks, and law enforcement officials, and as well the general public are also targets of such filings. We did create a national task force to draft model language, which Minnesota used for their task force. Those who were in the Minnesota task force in 2004 were county recorders, county attorneys, attorney general's office, district court officials, law enforcement officials, the Bankers Association, and the Bar Association. Those involved in this process believe this is a crime as it is used by the offender as a means of harassment. The offender retaliates against unsuspecting individuals for behavior they do not like, and they file a bogus lien on them in the state filing system. And most victims don't realize this until after they've went to obtain a loan to purchase a home or refinance a home in many cases. Since the majority of the offenders are with very low financial means, this bill introduces both a civil and criminal penalty. I ask that you support this bill in an effort to not only protect the victims of this crime, but to deter offenders by imposing the harsher penalties. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Harvey. Any questions for Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I generally like the idea, and to address a problem like this, to address it by an expedited proceeding, because I think it's a better way to shine light in on a process. But what I'm wondering about is, and this is either for Representative Vandeveer or the testifier, who gets the who's the lion's share of victims in these cases? Is it court personnel, or are we talking about inmates, or is that just a plurality? Is it a majority of them, or is it regular folks? I mean, I'm trying to get an idea about who we're really trying to protect here mostly.
Ms. Harvey?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh. The lion's share is public officials. For the most part, unfortunately, as a filing officer, we're unable to determine on the face whether it is a bogus lien, unless we knew every public official that was out there and we could see the names. But I can tell you I recognize many of them. Our governor actually had some liens filed against him. Many of the county recorders, county officials. So I would say, and as far as numbers, we probably receive, for those that we can tell on the face, probably 25 to 30 a week. And the inmates are actually the individuals who file these against the public officials. There are also the general public who are affected by this, but again, since they're not aware of these liens out there until they actually do a financial transaction, we don't hear from them as often.
Representative Lesh.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the reason I'm asking is you said it was an epidemic, and the epidemic I'm assuming is in terms of prisoners doing it, correct? Or are other people doing it as much as prisoners?
Ms. Harvey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, the filers are. It is probably 50% of them are inmates, and the other 50% are individuals that eventually, in some cases, do become inmates.
Okay. And then just one more question. At the last hearing, someone had said, I'm not sure if it was you or not, said they were going to get comments from the real property section of the bar about this. Was that done? And if so, what did they say?
Ms. Harvey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh. Yes, Bert Black from our office was here with me as well. We did contact the real property section of the Bar Association. However, we have not heard back from them yet.
And Lesh?
Nothing further, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? All right, seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3526, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler, I will take House File 3283 off the table and get it back in front of us. So,
amendment.
Mr. Chair, I've got a replacement amendment for the one that you're going to offer. Is
that the eighth amendment?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, and that's to put the bill in the form that you would like?
It'll be in a darn good form, then, Mr. Chair.
All right, then I will move House Amendment H3283A8 to put the bill into the form that the author would like. Any discussion? Being none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Yeah. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I did forget there's one oral amendment to make on the bill, which I know that's in Dean and be glad to.
Okay.
Is authorized.
Well, I think we need to work with the
We'll work on that in a way to help. Okay, Mr. Chair, we'll make the oral amendment in health.
All right.
Thank you. What you now have, maybe Mr. Chung can explain the amendment if you'd like.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Randy Chun with House Research. The A8 amendment is intended to address a situation in which the federal government would allow states to allow current policies to be either exchanged into a qualifying policy or would allow issuers to issue riders, which would have the same effect. So we're adding a subdivision 8 to the long-term care insurance laws. Paragraph A deals with the voluntary exchange of a policy. Paragraph B refers to riders. And paragraph C directs the two commissioners to pursue any federal law changes that would allow this to occur. And the language being added in page 17, lines 34 and 35 is a cross-reference. It's being added to the DHS language. It's a cross-reference to the new language being added in Subdivision 8.
All right.
And Mr. Chair, just for the context of the bill, since you weren't able to be present for the really robust hearing we had on this topic before, the whole point of this is right now last year we passed some long-term care insurance provisions that if you had a qualifying long-term care insurance plan, after you used up your money, you could reserve some assets and not have those leaned against. And what the feds passed such a bill, and we had to modify ours to conform. And so when you get to the point that you use up your assets, you can retain assets for eligibility to get on the medical assistance so you can get your nursing home. Maybe you never need such a place. But anyway, so the person could use that. And then when the estate is settled, that same amount of money is withheld from the estate, so it can't be recovered. So there's a two-feature thing. So, and it's the bill is here because of the recovery provisions, just for your information. So with that, Mr. Chair, our work is done on the bill. If there's other amendments, we can address those.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Chung before he leaves? Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chung, can you just repeat what you were saying as I was walking in? Did that have anything to do with what we had conversed about earlier?
Mr. Chung. Mr. Chair, no, it didn't. It doesn't deal with the earlier issue that we had talked about. What the amendment does is that it allows, if the federal government allows states to sort of convert existing long-term care policies into a qualified policy, either by issuing a rider or by exchanging a policy, then it basically states that those policies are qualified policies for purposes of the state's long-term care partnership program.
Okay.
Representative Westrum?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Chun, here's the issue and Representative Abler that I'm probably least resolved on. The tenants in common issue that came up last week, I understand where they're coming from the legal standpoint. But what's in here, and I understand maybe it's dictated by federal Medicaid laws, but I'm not convinced of that totally yet. But if somebody's got a protected policy of $100,000, for example, this bill and the recovery would be $100,000 if they protect their property, let's just say. And that's $100,000 at the day of protection. But then when it comes time to sell it, it's worth $125,000 because of appreciation. They don't get that. It was protected only at $100,000. Now, the flip side isn't true. If they protected at $100,000, liquidate all their other assets to become eligible for MA, and that property, or it could be a stock account that's protected, whatever it is, if that asset devalues to $75,000, they're now not protecting $100,000 of assets that they had because of the market. And that's the part that's kind of a heads you win, tails you lose situation for the beneficiary. And that's the part I'm struggling with yet. And I don't know the fix, and I don't know if we'll get it fixed here or not. But Mr. Chung, do you have any comments on that and any ideas on how we maybe could fix that so it's at least the valuing is done when they lock in the asset price? Or do you understand what I'm concerned with?
Representative Westman, we have a different witness who appears maybe can answer your question. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kim Carlin. I'm from Department of Human Services and Healthcare Eligibility and Access. Representative Westrom and I were discussing this issue. Basically, the federal law, the Deficit Reduction Act, changed the part of law that it addresses a state recovery for Medicaid. And it allows and gives specific language that we can now limit a state recovery for persons who have a qualified partnership policy that have utilized benefits in an amount equal to the benefits utilized. So the issue is, if somebody has utilized $100,000 worth of benefits under the policy, and they come and apply for medical assistance, they can protect $100,000 from a state recovery. That $100,000 in assets is disregarded for purposes of eligibility. The scenario that I believe Representative Westrom is describing is that $100,000 of assets that they have when they come to apply for medical assistance may depreciate in value over time. So by the time you get to a state recovery, the $100,000 that they protected is now worth only $75,000. To the extent that they don't have anything else to protect, that's what they end up with. On the other hand, if during their lifetime or as part of their estate, other assets have appreciated, those assets in that $25,000 that's left over wouldn't be allowed to be protected. But again, Representative Westrom is correct. If they don't have any other assets to protect, they would end up with the $75,000. On the other hand, if they have $100,000 at the time they apply, and at the time of a state recovery, that $100,000 of assets is appreciated to $200,000, they still would only be able to protect $100,000. We believe that that's as far as the federal law allows us to go with that limitation on the estate recovery.
Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, I'm just not happy. But I mean, I don't know what I can do. Best I can probably do is ask Mr. Chung in the future days ahead if he could look into this more, and him and I could get together to try to figure out if there's any way we could change this. But I hate to let the bill out of our possession, because I have more control here in our committee than I will with the next committee or the floor debate. And that's why I'd like a solution, but I don't know how we can get one right now.
I've been trying to find a way around this to actually freeze. My goal was to freeze the valuation as of eligibility, and then let the $100,000, if it goes up, then it stays as that protected asset. And we're not allowed to do that.
We're not.
No.
See, and that's what that seems to make sense to me, that it should work that way, but. I just would like to, I guess, read some language that at least tells us we can't do that. So hopefully in the next couple of days or week, we can work on that with staff, and we'll go from there.
And Mr. Chair, just for the advice of committee members, you've got a very friendly author on that side of the question here. That the future of this bill, and please let it go out today, is that it's going to go to health. There's a fiscal note we have to deal with. It'll either go on its own if we can resolve the fiscal note issues, or it'll be an omnibus. So this has a ways to go yet, and maybe if you're volunteering to be on the conference committee, if this is a standalone, I think that'd be a great place to put you. So,
all right.
Thank you.
I can't remember if I asked. Does anyone want to testify on this bill who has not already testified? Further discussion to the bill. All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3283 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And the members...
Bill leaving port, Mr.?
Pardon me?
Is this the last bill leaving port?
This is the last bill, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And members, this is not our last meeting, even though this may be the last bill that we pass, but I have agreed to do an informational meeting on one of Representative Simon's bills regarding instant runoff voting, probably in the next couple of weeks. So we will get together at least one more time, but for now, we are adjourned.